You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello, and welcome to The Dirt, a podcast about archaeology, anthropology, and our shared human past. I'm Anna.
And I'm Amber.
Before we jump into the episode, thank you to Kate for joining our Patreon and getting some of those sweet, sweet bonuses.
And we are creeping closer to that super secret special 100 patron gift, y'all. If you want to know what it is, you can just ask.
Yeah, you could ask us. We'll tell you. We're just not going to tell everybody all at once until it's ready. Listeners, there are lots of ways you can support The Dirt if you like the podcast. You can join our growing fam over at patreon.com/thedirtpodcast at any tier. You can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, which is a major help to us and free. You can recommend us to folks or assign our episodes in your classes. Any class, geometry, philosophy, shop class, sure, yeah. All of those things give the show a boost, and we are so grateful for every type of support we get from every one of you.
And on this week's installment of our summer field season, I am making use of that six-month subscription to a newspaper archives that I accidentally paid for, and we are heading out into the wild world of semi-fictional archaeology to explore some possible real-life inspirations for the world's most famous archaeologist and someone who happens to share a birthday with The Dirt, July 1st, Dr. Henry Walton Jones. So we've got ourselves a guy roundup today. But first,
round up the guys.
Come get your boys. But first, we should probably review the man himself.
Yes, Dr. Henry Walton Jones, Jr. Born July 1st,
1899 in Princeton, New Jersey.
Wow.
Huh. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I think a lot of archaeologists love the Indiana Jones trilogy. As far as I'm concerned, it is a trilogy, and we will be speaking no more about that. Put your tweets away.
But the fifth one has everyone in it.
Put that away.
They just keep casting people.
I'm in it now.
Look under your chair. You're in it.
Archaeologists do, not all of them, love this movie, but archaeologists also simultaneously deal with the cognitive dissonance of loving the adventures of a man who is very, very bad at archaeology. Right, let's face it, Dr. Jones the Younger does a lot of great research, reading maps, deciphering documents, sure, finding X's on floors in libraries.
They've been there the whole time.
But he also spends a lot of time destroying pieces of archaeological sites. He never writes anything down or records any context. And the phrase, "that belongs in a museum," hasn't aged well. Not everything belongs in a museum. Punching Nazis is good, though. We're fine with that. So Raiders of the Lost Ark, the first installment in Indy's adventures, is 40 years old this year.
Yeah.
Take that in for a moment. And despite the problems I just laid out, the iconic films did, for what it's worth, make archaeology a sexy. Is that a good thing? Sort of. I mean, it inspired lots of people to become archaeologists. I'm quoting here from a National Geographic article from 2015 titled, "How Indiana Jones Actually Changed Archaeology." It's a write-up of an exhibit at the National Geographic Museum that combined movie memorabilia with actual artifacts. And it'll be on our show notes.
Yeah.
Opening Thursday, Indiana Jones and the Adventure of Archaeology, I see what they did there, brings together movie memorabilia from Lucasfilm Limited, ancient objects from the Penn Museum, and historical materials from the National Geographic Society archives. Some of the artifacts are real. I mean, arguably all of the artifacts are real, like they exist in the material plane.
Yeah. But
some of the artifacts are real, including the world's oldest map, a cuneiform tablet showing the city of Nippur, pieces of 5,000-year-old Mesopotamian jewelry, and iconographic clay pots that helped unlock the mystery of the Nazca Lines. Other objects, like the Shankara stones, the cross of Coronado, and a Chachapoyan fertility idol, were imagined for the movies. But they still exist.
They're still
props. Yeah, they're still props. And then there are some that hover in the fact or fiction netherworld. The Holy Grail, for instance, and the Ark of the Covenant. Since no actual Ark has ever been found, the one built for the Raiders of the Lost Ark on display at this exhibit has become the iconic image, a case of life imitating art. Oh, they missed the chance there
life
to write
imitating
life imitating
Ark. Come on.
Come on. Yeah.
Come on.
Hire me, Nat Geo. The point, says
no, really.
Exhibit
hire me.
I'll write for you. The point, says exhibit curator Fred Hebert, a renowned archaeological fellow, meaning like a member of the like he's not just like, I'm a fellow. Hello.
At the National Geographic. This is written by National. Come on.
I'll write for you. Is so the point of the exhibit is to show how much these films have broadened the scope of archaeology and made the field more relevant and exciting to people everywhere. He goes on to say, these films introduced so many people to archaeology. We can document their impact statistically based on the number of archaeology students before and after the first film. Some of the best archaeologists in the world today say Indiana Jones was what sparked their initial interest. That's a great legacy for George Lucas and for the relationship between popular media and science. End quote. Is that a good legacy? I'm no longer quoting from that. When you break down exactly who these characters...
It's because of George Lucas that I grew up to become a TIE fighter.
That I grew up to become a small trash can shaped droid. Beep boop. Boop woo.
Oh, no. Go on.
So when you break down exactly who these characters are, what they're doing, and what that represents, it becomes thorny. These are stories about a white guy who shows up in countries colonized by various European powers and pings around trying to rescue artifacts or discover cities. It's impossible. It's impossible. I'm a writer. It's impossible, unfortunately, to have Indiana Jones without the accompanying specter of colonialism. So along those lines, here are a couple of excerpts from a 2018 piece on Hyperallergic by Daniel Gross, titled The Casual Colonialism of Lara Croft and Indiana Jones. And for the record, the Dirt podcast makes no claims that Lara Croft is an archaeologist. Just, again, put your tweets away. These characters still celebrate khaki-clad Western heroes who trample precious sites as they reduce the study of other cultures to a grabby hunt for treasure. Other works in the same genre include Tintin in the Congo, uh-huh. Secret of the Incas, The Mummy, what?
Tintin.
And his dog, Snowé. It should be like
Neiges.
Anyway, other works include the ones I just said, The Mummy, The Lost City of Z, and anything nice that has ever been said about Christopher Columbus. You won't find any of that on the Dirt podcast.
Sure won't.
The archaeological adventure story has had a considerable and troubling impact, according to Christopher Heaney, a Pennsylvania State University historian. He says, quote, what we consume when we're younger really, really shapes us, whether it's Indiana Jones or Leakey digging up hominids, end quote. Although the character of Indiana Jones arguably raised the profile of archaeology as a whole, and Lara Croft could inspire young women to go into the field, both figures have little regard for the cultures whose histories they collect. Heaney said, quote, it still promotes a problematic smash-and-grab mentality to irreplaceable artifacts and lives, end quote. Suzanne Pilar Birch, a University of Georgia anthropologist, is similarly critical of the archaeological adventure genre. She says, quote, it's part of the colonialist tradition that reinforces the white heteropatriarchy, if you want to use jargon, end quote. I mean, if you do, that's a good one to use. Still, the genre's enduring popularity doesn't surprise her. She said, quote, maybe that's the most realistic thing about the movie. Archaeology is still a very white discipline, and field archaeology is still very male, end quote. And so here's the kicker from that article. The problem is that these films rarely spend any time considering the actual cultures from which artifacts are stolen. Indiana Jones is supposedly a professor. He got his PhD. He's Dr. Henry Walton Jones. But we almost never see him reading, writing, or speaking to the living descendants of the communities he supposedly studies. Artifacts that have cultural and spiritual value are described as either mysteries or priceless treasures. They exist to be solved or sold instead of preserved as the tangible heritage of past generations. End quote. So Can archaeologists enjoy Indiana Jones and similar adventure movies and franchises? Sure, I think so, but maybe we should also spend time sitting with the real context of those adventures. And maybe we need a new cinematic hero who's a more up-to-date archaeologist. Like a real person.
Well, until then.
Yeah, I don't have any suggestions. I'm not volunteering. I got a face for podcasting.
Oh, you got a great face.
Thanks.
So, if there's one thing people love doing, it's describing archaeologists as a real-life Indiana Jones. And if there's two things people really love doing, it's that, and then also describing old man archaeologists from America as the inspiration for Indiana Jones. So,
yeah, they're tied for first.
There are so many people that have been suggested as inspirations, including like anyone who was an archaeologist that went into the field before like 1976. Like just everybody.
It checks out.
There's some varying degrees of reliability of those suggestions, but let's focus today on a handful of the choicest options. So
only the one choicest
of the first
dude cuts.
I'm so sorry about all the barking.
It's just a very exciting day in the Zambelli dog household.
They're outside now. They're all outside barking.
So, okay.
Great.
Hey, they're dogs. What do you want?
Silence. Just a few minutes.
What do you want? What do we want? Silence. When do we want it?
Anytime. So one of the first suggestions I remember ever hearing kind of came as a duo. And that duo is James Henry Breasted and Robert Braidwood. So I've always assumed that the biggest connection is their affiliation with the University of Chicago, because that's where Indy got his PhD. Did you know that? He got his PhD at the University of Chicago. I know.
Wow.
I don't know why I know so much.
Did you just pull all of this off the dome? Did you just know this?
I knew a lot of this.
Oof.
So, but are either of these dudes particularly indie? If we're going to evaluate this purely on that belongs in a museum terms, then James Henry Breasted is your guy, because he's the one who founded the Oriental Institute at Chicago. Remember him? He's on the tympanum.
I do remember him, and thank you for also helpfully including his picture.
Do you see him?
He is being handed the light.
No, he's
of the
not.
Orient.
That's not him. That's that. No,
oh.
He's
that's man.
Yeah, that's just Western
just
man.
This is the
torch of civilization being handed from the east to the west. He is
he in the pith helmet on the right?
No, he's below the guy in the pith helmet.
Oh, he's just like, here's this face.
Yeah,
I'm looking at it.
He's holding a pot. Yeah. So he's on it. But so
I think he might also be holding a magnifying glass.
Oh yeah, I think
he's like looking at it.
He's
really
doing
closely.
An analysis.
Doing a science.
So the Oriental Institute is his baby, and it's now celebrating its 100th year. And so it's still called the Oriental Institute after 100 years. I'm not going to include this in the show notes. I did read an article where they're like, well, you know, that term's kind of fallen out of the vernacular. So we're going by the OI. So now if you go to their website, it just says OI. It's very funny.
OI indeed.
But as for daring, was he daring and dashing and all that stuff? Well, I found an article from 1898 in a newspaper from Wilmington, North Carolina. And I read this and I was just like, this is so old. I know that.
That's the thing. Like, you and I deal with prehistory, and yet show me an article from 1898 and I'm just like,
the march of time. I spent a lot of time reading articles from like the 50s, and just like having like 50 years, like 55 years difference in terms of tone. And I was reading stuff about James Henry Breasted. I was just like, oh, Victorians. here is him blowing some minds.
Okay.
Headline: how the pyramids were
erected.
I think it's supposed to be erected, but it just is maybe. And I was just like, is this a Victorian thing? You don't want to say it because it sounds too. Subheadline. A story of ancient Egypt. Professor Breasted describes the methods employed in heavy construction. Everything done by human strength. The workmanship was so skillful that the joints in the masonry were invisible. Article.
You hear that, ancient aliens?
1898. The visit which Professor James Henry Breasted paid Atlanta last week was like the throwing of a searchlight over the dark waters of the past when the world was young.
Was it?
A great many people would frankly confess that he made clear to them much that had been vague and mysterious about the most ancient civilization of which anything is known today.
Oh boy, have I got news for you, Victorians.
Yeah, so and then they say Professor Breasted is probably
typo.
Is probably the highest authority on Egyptology in America. He holds the chair of Egyptology at the University of Chicago and has charge of the Egyptian collections in the university's Oriental Museum and also of a similar collection in the Field Museum at the Old World's Fairgrounds. So he was a big deal and he was sort of one of the kind of cornerstones of American archaeology and its like development. And then there's his student, Robert Braidwood. And so it's often been argued, I've seen, that Robert Braidwood was the inspiration for Abner Ravenwood, who was
Indiana Jones's mentor, right?
His dissertation advisor and Marion's dad.
The proud owner of a really, truly luxuriant mustache.
I know. He looks sinister in this photo.
He does.
But he does.
Also looks like a friend of mine. A bit.
Sinister friend. So Braidwood, we mentioned when we talked about Jericho.
Yeah.
Briefly, because he worked in that region and he was a pioneer in archaeological research because he, along with his wife, who was also an archaeologist, Linda Braidwood, they worked together at Jarmo and a few other places. But they were really the ones that like made prehistory pop off in terms of like a subject of research. Mm-hmm. And so they looked at what would become to be understood as the Neolithic Revolution and moving from
the rise of agriculture
from nomadism to sedentism. And so very, like very big deals in archaeology. And so Robert and Linda Braidwood were married for 66 years and collaborators for almost all of that time. And until per the New York Times in 2003, here's obituary.
In a theme that we're going to have in this episode, just like New York Times obituary headlines are very funny.
Two archaeologists, Robert Braidwood, 95, and his wife, Linda Braidwood, 93, die. And so that's an unfortunate headline.
No, I know.
And I'll include the link here because they talk a little bit about their research. But what I find very sweet, and we don't see a lot of sweet things in this episode. So they passed away within hours of one another in the same hospital in 2003. So they were.
That is very sweet.
Yeah, they were each pioneers in their own right in the same field. Total power couple. And I will include a link to a really great Trailblazers piece on Linda Braidwood. And before we
got to get the rest of Trailblazers on the show. We're two for four.
We're almost there. There's one more little wrinkle in this one. That is a package that arrived at the University of Chicago's admissions office on December 12th, 2012. Do you know this story?
I read the script.
Okay, great. So it was addressed to Henry Walton Jones Jr. And so they were like, who? And so nobody in the directory matched that name. They're like, we don't have any faculty by that name. And then there was a student employee who was like, hey, that's Indiana Jones. And then according to the story that was published on the OI website about a past exhibition that they had, which included this, 6 days after its arrival, the mystery was solved. The package, a collection of replica props from the Indiana Jones films, had been purchased online and shipped by its maker from Guam to Italy. The original packaging was lost in transit, leaving only the parcel addressed to Henry Walton Jones Jr. at the University of Chicago, where it had been forwarded by the Postal Service. So it was...
So on the prop, it was like, this belongs to...
It was an envelope. It was a prop envelope in which he would have gotten some mail. And so like old-timey stamps and it's addressed. And so all of the props were inside the prop envelope and it had lost the packaging. The Postal Service was like, well, I guess I'll just send it along. Even though it would have been like, if it had a postmark at all, it would have been a postmark from like the 40s. But then again, I have gotten stuff via media mail that did arrive like years later. So maybe they were just like, oh, media mail did it again. And so the Oriental Institute, made a little
a little
mini exhibition about it of just being like,
stuff.
So
did the person who bought it was like, were they ever just like, that's my stuff?
I think maybe. And they were just like, that's funny. Or maybe they were just like, it didn't arrive and they just got it like a new one sent. I don't know. That's the real mystery.
Some guy in Italy is like, my stuff.
Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, Anna is going to introduce us to another contender of a more naturalist bent. Possibly, arguably, total smoke show. But we'll see. We'll see when we get back.
We're back. And next in our roundup of guys, we have Roy Chapman Andrews. This guy. Wow. Much like the inside of the back storage rooms of many a museum, there's a lot to unpack. We'll start with a bit of biographical information, most of this taken from a 2012 blog post at Scientific American. Roy Chapman Andrews, born January 26th, 1884, I almost went into like, born January 26, 1884, but that's not the right era. Arguably, it's never the right time for that voice. Roy Chapman Andrews was an American explorer, adventurer, naturalist, mammalogist, and later director of the American Museum of Natural History in New York. The best museum.
Quick thing that we should cut out.
All righty.
Is a mammalogist like what? Somebody who'd be like... I'm a boob man. Is that like a nice way to?
No, I think that would be something like a mammarian or something. Oh. Thank you. Dr. Breasted. I don't know if I'm going to cut that out. We'll see. See how I feel. As a young man, he worked as a taxidermist, a self-taught art.
Oh,
arguably
no.
A chilling sentence to pay for university. After graduation, he attempted to get a job at the Natural History Museum in New York, but at the time, there were no positions vacant. Chapman, however, responded that he was even willing to clean the floors if this could bring him into the museum. The folks at the Natural History Museum were surprised by his ardor, and he was hired as janitor and assistant taxidermist. Maybe mocking him in a friendly way, he was assigned every morning to mop the floors in the taxidermy studio. The afternoons were then devoted to real taxidermy.
So he just showed up and was like, give me a job. And they're like, thanks.
I really want a job.
I mean,
I got a mop. I like to sew animals together.
Mop together. He wasn't making jackalopes. He was.
No. But like sewing their part. Anyway, Andrews then visited Japan and China, where he collected animals and experienced the particularities of the Far East. Yikes. In 1920, he persuaded paleontologist and museum director Fairfield Osborne to organize an expedition into Asia to search for fossils of the early ancestors of mammals, including humans. Not the early ancestors of all mammals and humans grouped together, like the early ancestors of mammals and also of humans who are mammals. Between 1922 and 1939, Andrews and his team carried out 5 expeditions into previously poorly mapped or unknown areas of Central Asia, a vast desert plagued by blizzards, sandstorms, snakes, floods, bandits, civil war, and an insecure political situation. The mission of the expedition, carried out with an odd combination of automobiles and camels, was to recover geographical, archaeological, botanical, zoological, and geological data, but especially to discover the fossils of early hominids. This is a weird article.
Makes it sound like the camels were driving the cars.
That is a weird combination of automobiles and camels.
Big paws. They're pit paws. They don't have paws.
There are various elements in the Indiana Jones movie resembling the life of Roy Chapman Andrews. Indiana Jones is introduced in the first movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, 1981, venturing to Nepal, like Andrews ventured in the Far East.
I mean, Jones, okay.
Yeah, again, this is a weird article. Jones' most recognized attributes comprise a .38 Colt and a fedora hat, and various photos of Andrews show him with a broad-rimmed hat. Hmm. During expeditions, Andrews loved to hunt animals for collection or cooking, but he also used his pistols to defend the expedition from bandits, who he then cooked. No. Perhaps his best-known discovery was a collection of dinosaur eggs in the Gobi. The public went nuts for this, much to Andrews' chagrin. For one thing, he wasn't the first person to discover eggs. Specifically dinosaurs. Have you heard about eggs? They're amazing. A French priest had done it decades earlier. Ah, laser, sacre bleu.
Oh, no.
Oh, a priest would never swear like that. And for another, Andrews didn't even want to talk about it. He thought it distracted from a more important discovery, the full skeleton of an oviraptor, there to steal the eggs in question. Okay,
that was very cool.
Andrews, on the hazards of being an explorer, quote, "To meet the popular conception of an explorer, a man must have suffered cold, heat, starvation, fever, attacks from wild animals, and savage natives, yikes, and must have been bitten by snakes. Snakes are essential. If you haven't had snakes, real ones, you just can't be a proper explorer," end quote. Sir, well, I now more fully understand this clipping from a newspaper, which is...
Again, I've seen Hannah's newspaper clippings.
Yeah, no, this is a great one. Unfortunate divorce of the man who discovered dinosaur eggs. Roy Chapman Andrews and his wife, whose romance was so beautiful, again, this is in the newspaper, have just been separated by a Paris decree, though they were often called the most devoted couple in exploration, because they have faced death together so often in the Chinese deserts.
And then there's them holding a dead bird up.
Yeah, they're just like, here's... I'll take one wing, you take the other. I don't think that's a dead bird. I think, or is it taxidermied? I don't know. It's a golden eagle.
Okay.
It's like a golden eagle. Anyway, and there seems to be someone taking offense at the idea that Roy Chapman Andrews had anything to do with inspiring Indiana Jones. Amber, what's this little nugget you've pasted here for me?
I found on not one, but two, pieces of, information, yeah, about Roy Chapman Andrews that allowed comments. The others unfortunately didn't, but I think he would have done this too. We have a gentleman named Steve who's commented. I won't give his full name, but because this is exactly the kind of person that we would get a message from.
Yep.
And so Steve, last name withheld, writes, ellipsis. No, it wasn't, ellipsis. Whoever that guy was, he was definitely not the inspiration for Indiana Jones, ellipsis. So two different occasions.
Word for word, the same comment.
Just copying and pasting. Yeah. And so, okay, Steve.
Sure.
Nobody's sure, saying Steve. He was. So let's move on to someone else with another great name. Hiram Bingham III.
That's a good name.
Hiram Bingham III was not an archaeologist. He was a specialist in Latin American history before Latin American studies were even really a thing. And in fact, like, it was like hard for him to find someone to supervise him because it wasn't a topic of study. And they were just like, we don't do that. And so he ended up being, I think he was at Yale. He was a professor at Yale. And
he was his own supervisor.
That was after he got his PhD. So when he was a professor, he was at Yale, and he was in the South American Studies Department, South American history, because like Latin American history like wasn't recognized. So he taught courses on it because, dear listeners, Latin American studies did not really exist. There were people who did it. There were people who studied topics that fell within what is now the umbrella of Latin American studies. It didn't happen until well into the Cold War, because area studies were established and funded by Title VI. So there was a congressional action taken, and then that established area studies in the U.S. because they wanted to have specialists in different regions of the world, and particularly the third world, so that we could better counter the threat of communism. So that's how Latin American studies came about, as like all the other types of studies. If you're in Middle Eastern studies, like area studies in general, that's when that came about. So he was sort of ahead of the curve there. And in 1911, he's possibly most famous for, in 1911, he discovered Machu Picchu in Peru. And much like Angkor, remember we had like the white guy who discovered it, but actually not only were people like, well, yeah, it's right there, but also there were like previous white guys that had shown up and like had also seen it. And it was a situation like this, because I think in like the 1870s, there was a map, like a European made map that had Machu Picchu on it. I will read you a little bit from an article that was syndicated in 1913. Palaces on Peru Plateau. Explorer tells of buried Inca city uncovered in jungle, had trouble with officials. Professor Hiram Bingham, head of the Yale Peruvian expedition, which has been conducting archaeological exploration work in the interior of Peru, reached New York with other members of the party from Colón. Professor Bingham said the exploration was conducted chiefly at Machu Picchu, the buried Inca city discovered on the previous expedition, which stands on a plateau surrounded by precipices 2,000 feet in height. The jungle was cleared away and more than 100 burial caves were discovered. Ruins of baths, houses, and palaces were also laid bare, and practically the entire city uncovered. Professor Bingham added that the jungle will soon cover them again unless steps are taken by the Peruvian government to keep them open. So remember, he's the head of this expedition, not an archaeologist.
Nope.
Other things that he did, he was the governor of Connecticut for one day.
How'd he do?
He did okay. And so he had been the lieutenant governor, and then like the governor.
Did somebody die?
I think the governor died by suicide. And he was governor. So there was a special election. And so he was elected. And I think he was just like, was lieutenant governor. And then for one day, but he had also been elected senator of Connecticut. So he was there for one day, enough time to resign so that he could go be senator. And so he was senator for Connecticut for two terms. There was a scandal. And then he stopped being in the Senate and he just like kicked it. But on one of the articles that I found, Steve's back.
The same Steve.
The same guy, same Facebook picture, who says, no, it wasn't. Whoever that guy was, he was definitely not the inspiration for Indiana Jones.
Steve.
And I'm so sorry to report that like nothing else that I used enabled comments.
If they had, Steve would have been there.
So let's take another quick break. Again, we're not saying that any of these people were the inspiration for Indiana Jones.
Ellipsis.
We'll be right back.
We're back. And before we finish off this episode with Amber's very special curated pick, I'm going to take us through a brief bro-down hoedown of a couple more historical dudes who might have contributed to the mythos of Indiana Jones. Calm down, Steve. And in case you're wondering just how many composite historical guys make up one Indiana Jones, according to Wikipedia's Indiana Jones entry under historical models, there are 18. 18 guys. But I'm just going to talk about two of them. Our first is William Montgomery McGovern. All of these names just like they have the same ring to them. They have the same something. Mm-hmm. McGovern was a political science professor at Northwestern University, and they are very proud of him. And actually, he seems to have been a pretty stand-up guy. according to Northwestern University. But in general, he seems to have been a pretty cool guy. And here are some excerpts from a post on Northwestern University's website about him. It was the early 1920s, and the young adventurer William Montgomery McGovern had managed to sneak into Lhasa, the forbidden city of Tibet. Few, if any, Westerners had ever made the journey. To reach Lhasa, McGovern disguised himself as a servant and crossed the Himalayas in the middle of winter with Tibetan guides. During the journey, they got lost in a snowstorm, and McGovern came down with dysentery. So far, ticking all the white guy explorer boxes, only because there aren't snakes where there are snowstorms. During his life, McGovern became a legendary political science professor who taught packed classes.
Legendary political science professor.
Who taught packed classes in Northwestern's Harris Hall, served as a military advisor in World War II, and earned a reputation as an unabashed conservative in an increasingly liberal academic world. Cool. Most of all, he was famous for his perilous adventures around the world. McGovern was a born adventurer. According to Time magazine in 1938, quote, his mother once took him to Mexico just to see a revolution, end quote. Although he was born in New York City in 1897, he spent much of his youth in Asia. At age 20, he earned a divinity degree from a Buddhist monastery in Kyoto, Japan. And in 1920, he published a book on learning colloquial Japanese. In 1922, he earned his doctorate from Oxford University's Christ Church College. Students and fellow faculty members knew McGovern as a charismatic, eccentric teacher and a captivating storyteller.
I'm starting to see in this next line why perhaps he had packed classes at Northwestern's Harris Hall.
Described by the Newark Ledger in 1924 as a, quote, delicate-looking man of medium height with fair face and dreamy blue eyes, end quote, McGovern later became known during his Northwestern days for his wild, unkempt hair, his ever-present pipe, and the large otter fur cap and otter fur coat that he wore in winter.
Ah, man. The real, like, hottie to weirdo pipeline, I see.
Hottie to otter. McGovern taught large lecture classes such as nationalism, politics of the Far East, Asia in world politics, and classical, modern, and contemporary thought. 60 years ahead of his time, McGovern also unsuccessfully encouraged President Franklin Bliss Snyder to create a Latin American studies program at Northwestern.
Oh!
He was also, yeah.
See my previous point.
So yeah, well, he's no Hiram Bingham, but you know. He was also vehemently opposed to McCarthyism and remained a vocal liberal his whole career, which contradicts the sentence before where they said that he was a conservative. So
well,
I am
just
confused.
Like wasn't a fascist?
Yeah, I guess.
Is that like, I mean, hey.
Hey, we'll take it.
Get in
so
here.
That article goes on with just gleeful flair, but let's move on to guy number two, who is Walter Fairservice. This comes from another winner of a New York Times obituary with a title that is very particular about the order of events.
I don't know why they have to put that verb in the, like, we know it's in the obituary section.
Yeah, obituary, like QED. Anyway. Anyway, here's the title. Walter A. Fairservice, 73, dies, was archaeologist and author. So... Are you ready for a whirlwind description of a career? Buckle up. Here we go. Dr. Fairservice entered the Army Intelligence Branch in World War II and was assigned to General Douglas MacArthur's staff in Japan before returning to the museum in New York as a full-time staff archaeologist. He soon made a name for himself locating and exploring lost cities, some known only from legend. In 1949, he led the first American archaeological expedition to Afghanistan, where he and two associates found the imposing ruins of a long-forgotten imperial city. Could not find which one.
It was forgotten.
I looked.
They forgot.
But not after.
And long-forgotten. I mean, you don't. With, tell me what in that syntax suggests that.
Yeah. Fair point. In 1960, Dr. Fairservice led a team to Pakistan and discovered a sprawling ceremonial complex. The find shed new light on the prehistoric Harappan civilization and the ancient people then inhabiting Baluchistan and the Indus Valley. While continuing his travels to remote regions, he prepared a Costumes of the East exhibition at the museum in 1970.
It was boat shoes. I'm just thinking of like New Englanders, and I got some boat shoes.
Vineyard vines, belts. Those rope bracelets that are braided and then you wear them forever and they smell awful.
I'm trying to think of things. It was like when we were in college. So I'm just like puffy vests.
Yeah.
Collared shirts with the collars
pop. Collar. Yep. Mm-hmm. Sartorial decisions I regret.
Costumes of the East.
Anyway, he made a different type of costumes of the East exhibition.
He's trying to rehabilitate his image.
At the museum in 1970. Well, it's not going to work because here we go. That exhibition provided a taste of what was to come. The largest anthropological exhibition in the museum's history, the Gardner D. Stout Hall of Asian Peoples. Woof. For 14 years, Dr. Fairservice served as the scientific authority in planning that hall, which opened in 1980.
Yikes!
Yikes-a-roni.
Yikes!
Here's a statement that makes me feel great about my writing deadlines. He was a prolific writer of books too numerous for even him to remember, he said. Cool for you, sir. Said books included The Roots of Ancient India, 1969, The Ancient Kingdoms of the Nile and the Doomed Monuments of Nubia, 1962, and Cave Paintings of the Great Hunters, 1959. Most recently, he wrote The Harappan Civilization and Its Writing, a model for the decipherment of the Indus script, 1992.
This worked out
short
well.
Book. It's a really short book. What's it say? We don't know. And The Archaeology of the Southern Gobi, Mongolia, 1993. And then here's how it ends. He also wrote many plays, some of which were produced by the East-West Fusion Theater, which was housed at his estate called Fairland. Again, a very cool.
Oh, man.
Oh, take us home, Amber.
What a cringe monster. Oh, my gosh. Oh. Okay, well, I'm obsessed with him now. Thank you. Because as some people may know.
Specifically me.
I'm really into mid-century American archaeological research. And specifically, I am most into my golden boy, Wendell Phillips, America's Lawrence of Arabia. And I think this episode was really just, I was like, I could talk about Wendell Phillips, and we've spent a while talking about people who aren't Wendell Phillips. But this is great because he has a lot in common with many of these folks and also was inspired and modeled off of some of them. So Wendell Phillips is, I think he's like the latest guy to become active in the field. So roughly contemporary.
Like in this lineup of guys.
Yeah, of these guys mm-hmm. that we've talked about. Like roughly contemporary with Fairservice. Roughly contemporary with Braidwood. But he was born in 1921 to a working class family in Oakland, California. And so he was very much like his life was very much informed by the Great Depression. And so he was like really scrappy and seems pretty clever, although there are many forms of intelligence, as we will find out with Wendell Phillips.
You can be a clever doofus.
And so he was a student at the University of California, Berkeley, studying paleontology. And then he enlisted in the Merchant Marines and served in World War II. And then he got polio. And that is what set him on his course. So while he had polio and he was recovering, because he got it about 8 years before the first vaccines came out, he had always been really into like adventure stories, and he was a big fan of Roy Chapman Andrews. So he got it in his head that when he got better, what he was going to do was plan the biggest, baddest, boldest, best expedition the continent of Africa had ever seen. And so he just like
Africa,
started,
huh?
He just started writing letters to people and sort of being like, hey, I'm into what you're doing. This is great. And he was like a sales guy. So he was really good at convincing people of things, of convincing corporations to sponsor him. And so he led this huge expedition from like Egypt down to South Africa that was like 26 months long and had like 120 people on it. And he just like convinced UC Berkeley to like cover some of it and got like Chrysler to like give them trucks and just like had all of this stuff.
Yeah,
and
this expedition sponsored by Chrysler.
But yeah, and so it was product, there was product placement, there was corporate sponsorship.
Because there was news coverage of all of this.
Oh, and that was something else that he was really good at, was like getting the press to follow him. So it was a lot of like splashy press. That expedition worked at Swartkrans in South Africa.
I am familiar.
And like I saw that like the cave was discovered in 1948. And so I perhaps it was discovered on that expedition. So this is what set him on his course of being a guy who was really good at talking people into stuff and really good at talking about himself, but didn't really know anything about anything. Because remember, he graduated with a degree in paleontology, which is something that he shares with most of the people on this list of people who are considered inspirations for Indiana Jones by everybody but Steve, that they're not archaeologists. Most of the people are not archaeologists. They are other things. And and I would argue that Wendell Phillips is an other thing.
he's definitely something else.
And so that went off well. Like that was successful, according to him. But I haven't gotten to that part of my research.
He's the one writing the books.
He was the one writing the books and sort of conducting the interviews and stuff. And so after that, he was like, this is great. I found my calling. I'm establishing the American Foundation for the Study of Man. And so he became the president of it.
He did.
And then he was like, he ran into the Aga Khan, who was like perhaps you should go to the Aga Khan.
Ruler of.
It's like a title that.
A hereditary title.
Yeah, it's a hereditary title. But yeah, he ran into him and he was like, perhaps you should go to Arabia. And he was like, oh my God, I should go to Arabia. And so he decided that he was going to go find the Queen of Sheba. And so he did his thing and got a bunch of corporate sponsorship and all of this stuff and like talked a bunch of people out of their money and got a bunch of his bros to come with him. So it was a bunch of like 20 somethings named like Kenny and Dick and like Wade, like actual names 50s. Of guys that were there. And then, so it was them. And then there was this William Foxwell Albright, who was like,
he sounds rich.
He sounds stodgy. So he was a biblical archaeologist and like a Semitic philologist. And like, he just he was the head archaeologist, but he seems like he just kind of showed up. And so they just kicked it. So they kicked it in Yemen. And I wanted to share a couple things about how people perceived him outside of himself.
People in the US, in Yemen,
I'm getting there.
Okay.
Because
tell me more.
People in the U.S. had a very specific idea of him because he kind of controlled the media coverage. He wrote articles that were distributed by the United Press and the Associated Press.
Oh, that's how you do it.
He was like kind of cute and like charming.
Yeah, he was a weedy kind of.
Very
earnest.
Yeah.
Open-faced kind of guy.
Yeah.
Like a sandwich. Open-faced.
Was just a little tartine. And so he wrote his own book. He wrote a book about it. And if you look, Anna,
I'm looking,
look at one of the poll quote, like the reviews on the back. Who reviewed it? Roy Chapman Andrews says one of the most important archaeological expeditions of the last two decades. It was really, positive coverage, curious coverage,
what's he doing over there?
Yeah, what's he doing? Oh, he's so smart. He's so great. Oh, he's a leader of all this stuff. Oh my God. But for the like colonial administration, so what is now, so he was working in what is now Yemen, but it was actually kind of distributed across several polities, including varying degrees of British control and varying degrees of like local leadership. And so he did a season in Behan, which is, is now a city in Yemen, but it was just the Emirate of Behan. And then he came back in Behan. And at the end of it, the British, Charles Ng, who's the guy at the Foreign Office, was like, you're an idiot. Your team sucks. You got to stop. And he's like, I don't care. I got permission to excavate in Yemen. I'm going to Marib. And Marib is is argued by some to be the capital of Sheba, which would have been Sheba. Which is where the Queen of Sheba was. So he got permission
to go find Bilqis.
he got the permission to go work in Marib. So he and his secretary left. And so that's why listeners to the show, I will have presented a paper on his secretary's role this weekend. But
it's a great paper.
Oh, thanks. They left to go do a press junket in the U.S. and get more money. And then part of his team went on to Marib. The Dick and the Wade and the Kenny, they went. On the 9th of February, so I'm pretty sure he left on the 7th.
Oh, yeah. 2 days.
So he and Eileen Salama, his secretary, were in the U.S. and like London. They did some interviews there too. Through January up until the first week of February. So on February 9th, and this is from the UK National Archives blog. There's a really amazing blog post on how the British Foreign Office felt about Wendell Phillips, because they all thought he sucked. Like they all thought he was like a total idiot and a liar and just like a huge pain and super rude. And he also, in his own writing, like clearly had an issue with the British, because it was sort of this sense of like competition and kind of a chip on his shoulder. And it was very,
we call that a fry on our shoulder.
So in these notes from one person to another, this is Jacob to Dudgeon, the two guys who are involved in the Foreign Office. He writes, his party is always heavily armed and carries a large amount of ammunition. It is composed mostly of very young men whose literature includes such books as the schoolboy's edition of Lawrence of Arabia. This may sound very disparaging, but gives you a true picture of the qualifications of the expedition. Nevertheless, it is unfortunate that even this sort of expedition seems unable to tell us about Marib.
Wow.
And then his next point in this memo is, Phillips left Taiz with his party on the 7th of February by aeroplane for Marib. Unless he can change the present arrangements, he should leave the Yemen by the 31st of March. So the projected plan was that they were going to excavate there.
Okay.
So what was happening in the while he was away and then in that first week that he was there was they were bad at it. And so there were a lot of the
Wade and Kenny and Dick
at all. They were under sort of surveillance. They were under watch by soldiers sent there by the king. And so the Yemeni authority said that they felt that they were smuggling antiquities out and they didn't trust him, which is and then they felt that they were keeping them, that they were sort of like keeping them hostage. And it was this whole thing. And there was a
general distrust by everyone towards everyone.
And so a week later, on the 12th of February, at like 6 a.m. or something, they wake up and they pack some of their stuff, like, but very quietly. They put some film canisters and a box of Post Toasties and like,
you really have done your research.
Well, like that's, they talk about the Post Toasties because it's product placement.
Yes. And they drove away in their Dodge Caravan.
It was their Dodge Power Wagon. So they all got it and they told the guards, they're like, oh, we need to go over to site and get some photos. That's why we got to bring the guys. And they're like, okay. And okay. So they got in the car and they're like, let's go. And they like,
we gotta booked go. It.
And so they left behind like almost like $250,000 in like 1952 money of equipment. They also hadn't paid any of their workers.
Oh, cool.
And so the workers were like upset about it and they were like, they were gonna kill us. And there was like, they probably like might like go on strike. And so there was a lot of like back and forth about what might have happened. But what he did was he first went to they went to Aden and then they went on to Oman and he became friends with the Sultan of Muscat and Oman and was gifted with a rather large oil concession. And that's when Wendell Phillips shifted from archaeology to being president of the Wendell Phillips Oil Company. So he became sort of like, oh, like a rich guy, like a curious,
a wealthy
like
guy who was also into antiquities.
He still did his expeditions and he subsidized from that point on, like the American Foundation for the Study of Man. And he was just sort of like a, he was a guy that like loved press attention and all this stuff. And one last thing I want to share about him is notes of a meeting between Higginbotham, who was the governor of Aden.
He was a British colonial diplomat official.
And so these are notes from a meeting between him and Phillips in November 1954. So a couple years, so he had just been like failing upward through the whole thing. Higginbotham notes, Mr. Wendell Phillips was in very good form, very outspoken, apparently extremely anxious to be of assistance. And everything he said, he wished it to be understood, was from his heart. And he did not in any way deviate from what was strictly true. In other words, Mr. Wendell Phillips was his old self and just as big a liar as ever. And so I think that I wanted to end on my golden boy, because I think that he is possibly based on all of these other examples that we use.
In that Indiana Jones is a fictional character and a composite of possibly some of these men that we talked about. He's as much his own fictional character. He's as much Indiana Jones as any of them.
Yeah. And so something else that he did, they were talking about how they have so much ammunition and stuff. So Wendell Phillips wore two Colts on his hip.
Colt 38s,
the same thing that Roy Chapman Andrews had, same thing that Indiana Jones has, like that's sort of like, that's what like, oh, that's like what the like archaeological cowboys like wear. And so like people like the British and stuff like called him like Wendell the Kid and Cowboy Phillips, and he hated it because Ed also used a terrible shot. I have read so many accounts of people describing of like talking about him like just shooting for fun, which is like a valid pastime.
Shooting cans,
trying to shoot spiders. They have like large spiders. So like, no, like
still,
I know that's not a good way to dispose of a spider. If you feel that you need to, I get it. They're very scary. But they were talking about shooting cans and he could not hit them. And there's like video footage of like him shooting and be like, pew, 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 pew.
I'm a cowboy.
Which like, maybe this is just me showing my like good marksperson privilege, but like, come on.
Are you a good shot?
I'm a very good shot.
Wow. I've never shot a gun. I'm more of a bow and arrow kind of kid. That's what I bring to the desert. Two of them. Oh gosh. But, well,
that's
your golden boy.
That's my golden boy. So if you ever have any questions about Wendell Phillips, feel free to ask me. I feel like I'm going to very soon become the world's foremost expert on him. But what I was trying to say is like Wendell Phillips is, if you took all of those other guys that we talked about and sort of rolled them
into one.
Essence
of explorer. Yeah.
That is what happens if you model yourself off of these adventure types, because Steven Spielberg and George Lucas and Lawrence Kasdan, see the screenwriter?
You know, as we've established, far more about Indiana Jones, first of all, than anyone needs to. And second of all,
there are transcripts of like conversations of them hammering out the plot. And it's like, not, they didn't mention these guys. They talked about that Charlton Heston movie, The Secrets of the Incas, like, or whatever it is. Like,
but
like,
all of this was in the zeitgeist because it's informed by the news coverage of these dudes.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was fun. So, was fun.
Oh,
one.
Good. I'm glad you had fun.
I did have fun.
I love talking about this.
Listeners, we hope you also enjoyed this field season installment and all of our boys.
It was a little bit of a summer break.
Yeah, a little summer cinema, kind of.
Wah, 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 wah.
Wah, wah, wah. Anyway, we'll be back in your ears next week with a new episode. But until then, if you miss us, you can find all of our back episodes, literal days of listening, at thedirtpod.com. You can also find us on social media.
We're on Facebook, The Dirt Podcast. We're on Twitter at The Dirt Pod.
Nope.
And we're on Twitter at Dirt Podcast.
That's the one.
And we're on Instagram at The Dirt Pod. And all of that stuff is over on our website,
thedirtpod.com. And also over on our website, you can get yourself some merch. You can see our syllabus for educators, and there's a whole bunch of other fun stuff. But most of all, we just love that you listen. Thanks, everybody.
I tried to think of something Indiana Jones would say, and I was just like, I hate snakes.
Snakes are all right. Good catchphrase. He says that.
Mm-hmm.
Fedora. He says that. Goodbye.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.